Transportation Committee. Let the record show that it's February 24th, and the time is 1 o'clock. On today's agenda, we have the Metropolitan Council giving us their budget presentation. We'd like to welcome to the committee Patrick Bourne, the Regional Administrator, Arlene McCarthy, Metropolitan Transportation Services Director, and Judd Shetnan, the Government Affairs Director. At your direction, Judd, I think we'll just proceed with the overview.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, my name is Judd Shetnan. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. We would like to present the Governor's budget recommendations for Metropolitan Area Transit. And as you mentioned, we have our new Regional Administrator with us today, Mr. Pat Bourne, and we'll allow him to introduce himself.
Mr. Bourne.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for scheduling this hearing today. I am Pat Bourne. I'm the Regional Administrator on the job for about 2 weeks. So the heavy lifting today will be done by Arlene McCarthy, who you, I'm sure, know. But I just want to make a few brief remarks, if I might. The Governor's budget is the topic today, and the Governor's budget as it relates to the state's general fund contribution toward transportation funding of the Metropolitan Council is what we will address. We're happy to answer other questions you have, but that's our topic for the day today. As you know, the Governor's budget calls for spending reductions, tax increases, and the spending reductions that relate to the Metropolitan Council are a portion of those that are directed toward the Metropolitan Council are what we're going to address today as well. You may have read a couple days ago and seen other media reports that we might be here today to talk about fare increases. That would not be accurate. We're happy to talk about fare policy and frequency of fare changes. We don't have any pending increases right now and don't plan any for the immediate future. We do mention that fare increases from time to time are options that we consider and do from time to time. But I want to reiterate that that's not our topic today, but we'll certainly answer questions for you. This budget does call for service cuts, a reduction in general fund appropriation. We are preparing options for what that means to those who use our transit service. We can talk to you today. We're going to give you a little context for today about what that might mean and what the general fund appropriation means for the rest of the transit budget. And with that, I'll turn this over to Arlene McCarthy, our general manager in charge of transportation, and who I'm sure you know.
Well, thank you, Mr. Bourne. And could you give us just a brief history of how you come to be the Regional Administrator. I have presenter here, but a typo on my agenda. But how you came to your position, your years with Met Council.
We
appreciate that.
I've been on the job for about 2 weeks. For the 10 years before that, I've been in public service as the chief financial officer for the city of Minneapolis. For the 20 years preceding that, I was in the public finance business where I advised state and local governments about raising capital and representing their interests in large financial and business transactions, both in Minnesota and outside of Minnesota. Transit was one of my subject matters, but so was housing, student loans, toll roads, the whole gamut of public finance work. And early in my career, I actually spent time in this room as a legislative fiscal analyst back in the 70s, and I also spent a little time in the state, what was then known as the State Finance Department, now MMB, doing other financially related work. So I've been around the public sector, public service, public finance, general management work all of my working life, and I'm excited to have the opportunity to be the regional administrator at the Metropolitan Council, a government agency that I admire not only their work but their people, and I'm very proud to be among them, and I'm happy to be doing this work and to be one of its leaders.
Thank you for for that. We appreciate it and the depth of your certainly financial knowledge and workings within government at all levels, it sounds like. Your experience will be very much appreciated as we work through the issues relating to the Met Council and transit.
Mr. Chair, I didn't answer your very specific question on how did I get this job. It was a call in the middle of the night. And not quite. I'm exaggerating.
Again, thank you. Senator Dibble.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would commend an article that was written about Mr. Bourne a couple weeks ago in Star Tribune. One of those newspaper articles we all pray for. Very laudatory, announcing his departure from the city of Minneapolis and describing his time at the city of Minneapolis and the number of vexing issues that he took on and persuaded the political leadership to support, and mentioning his transition to the Met Council. So it's good article. What do they call the honeymoon article? And now they're going to come after you.
There is that honeymoon period. Thank you, Senator Dibble. Judd, if you'd should say, Mr. Shetland, if you would like to proceed.
Great. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I'm going to turn this over to Ms. McCarthy at this point, and then we'll go through the budget. Then we'd be happy to answer questions during the presentation or at the end, whatever you'd prefer.
Great. Ms. McCarthy. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, my name is Arlene McCarthy, Director of Metropolitan Transportation Services at the Met Council. Just to summarize what the governor's recommendation is, you see here on this slide, for the biennium, we're talking about $10.8 million or $5.4 million each year of the biennium. This is equivalent to a 9% reduction in our base bus appropriation. However, as you will see later, we do have quite a few different funding sources, so we don't get too focused on the fact that this is a bus appropriation because we take all of our funds and apply our funding sources across the needs of all of the different type of services. So there will be a regional impact to any budget changes that we have at the council. This will impact all the modes and all of the providers. And to give you a little bit more detail on that, this is what we call the family of services. I think you're familiar with most of them. We presented on this in January, so I won't dwell, other than to say that they do have different rules and different ways we provide these services, but one key thing for you to know is with Metro Mobility, we have both federal and state requirements to comply with. Metro Mobility, per the federal ADA law, we must provide service where there is all-day regular route service, and our goal must be zero denials, and they are very strict about that in monitoring. So having that level of service is always a top priority for our budgeting. But I think you're familiar with them, the rest of the services that we described back in late January. We'd like to just take a moment and pause and let you know that we do think we provide a very high-quality service here in this region. Historically, we have performed very well compared to our peers. Through the legislature, we are required every 2 years to produce a transit performance report, which we do. We compare ourselves usually to 11 peer cities that have similar transit systems to us, similar types of service, and similar in size. And we always rank quite well when we compare ourselves to our peers, particularly in what's called fare box recovery, how much the passengers pay. And then very recently was a U.S. News and World Report article just last month that looked at the transit systems across the country, and the Twin Cities here was ranked fifth in the country. So we were very happy to see that from a neutral body. And then there's just some efficiency measures we always like to highlight. Our ridership growth has outpaced our peers, and our subsidy per trip is quite a bit lower than our peers. And as I mentioned, so our fare box recovery is higher. And we do a marketing survey every couple of years of our customers. And with our last survey, more than 90% of our customers were fully satisfied with the service that they receive.
Ms. McCarthy, could you describe for us how that that survey is completed? What are some of the criteria? Who do you actually survey?
Oh, certainly.
Across the board, you know, maybe a little bit about the numbers of people that are surveyed actually participate.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I don't have the nitty-gritty details on that, and we'd be happy to provide that to you, but I do know that we work with an external consultant typically so that we have a statistically sound sample. This is focused on regular routes, so that means the bus service and the light rail service and now commuter rail. And we haven't in the past as regularly done surveys on Metro Mobility or the Dial-A-Ride, but we do plan to add that. We always work towards, this is typically handled in the fall after the U of M has started up. We pick a time when there are not holidays, so we're trying to make sure we're getting a good sample of regular customers. And then we select quite a variety of different types of service, different routes, different times of the day, days of the week, to get that sample. And again, we do put out a pretty nice report that summarizes that, and perhaps we could provide that report to the committee, the most recent report.
We'd appreciate that, Ms.
Okay.
McCarthy.
I think that most of you would understand that ridership is dependent on level of service. How much service is out there is really what makes service attractive or less attractive if there isn't very much of it for people. But we do know from the survey that we just mentioned that our ridership is really focused on going mostly to and from work or to and from school. Of course, many others are, there are leisure trips and things like that, but the majority are to and from work and to and from school. And I don't think it's a surprise for you that the greatest impact of transit when we have the highest levels of service on the street by far is in the peak commuter hours on the weekdays. We have very good transit service to downtown Minneapolis and to the University of Minnesota and downtown St. Paul. Those are the three strongest transit markets in this region. The Downtown Council, the business group in Minneapolis, did a survey back in 2008 that demonstrated 40% of downtown Minneapolis workers use transit. And that has been substantiated by past surveys through other organizations. For example, the city of Minneapolis regularly does what we call cordon counts. They track people coming in to the city and how they're coming in and where. And their research has substantiated this. And it's important to know that this does have an impact on our roads. For example, on 35W, which is our strongest transit corridor from a ridership perspective, if those folks were driving in an auto alone in the peak hour, it would equate to an extra lane and a half of traffic. So there is a trade-off between transit and road capacity needs. And then finally, from the survey, we also know that many of our riders are choice riders. That kind of gets back to that going to work that many of them are doing. As you can see here, 80% of our LRT and 56% of our bus riders do own a vehicle. In other words, they could drive if they chose to. And many of them have household incomes above $50,000, so they could afford to drive also if they chose to. This chart is a summary of ridership over about the last decade. Mr. Chair, I'd like to focus on the low bar and the high bar on this chart. So first, in 2004, I think you will recall that that was the year of the transit strike. And as a result, service was not on the street for a few days, and that, of course, impacted ridership. So that was a drop. It was also the year that we started up the Hiawatha Light Rail, which is why you see yellow there for the first time in 2004. Now, 2008 was the high point, and you will recall that's when gas prices were at about $4 a gallon. And there was really quite a response to those gas prices in that we had a spike in ridership due to that. Overall, while the bars in the last few years go up and down a little bit, overall, though, our ridership is at its strongest point compared to the last 25 years. So it has been generally growing, and we think we're strong in that compared to the rest of the country. At Met Council and Metro Transit, we are always looking for ways to provide a more efficient service, provide better customer service, and we've listed here some of the more recent efficiency improvements that we have done. The first three are a technology focus. A few years back, we invested in an upgraded scheduling system. They had understandably become more sophisticated over time. And we invested in a system that puts the work together. So we schedule our trips, and you piece the work together and put it out there to be operated by the bus drivers. And we did an investment in this system, and as a result, we were able to have an annual savings for the same service on the street, essentially, of $2.6 million, and it required 50 less operators. So, and of course, that's an ongoing savings year in and year out. We also installed GPS technology on our buses in the last decade. This helps us know exactly how long it takes to drive each trip and by segment every day. And so that's really valuable data so that the people that schedule the service can really have schedules that reflect what it really takes. And we were able to improve, tighten the schedule, so to speak, to reflect the actual driving time. And then on the customer side of things, we have been able to speed up our boarding when we switch to the electronic fare collection. Some of you might be familiar with the Go-To card. It's a proximity card, and it's really quite amazing. Instead of every person stopping at the fare box and putting in their card and having it spit out, instead people just walk by, and their proximity card registers their fare. And it has really helped speed up our operations. If you have ever been down at the University of Minnesota and seen large groups of students and people boarding buses at once, they really just keep on walking. And we've really had some great improvement. And, of course, as I said, our customers are much happier because the routes are faster. The last two items on this slide deal with energy efficiencies. Metro Transit has invested quite a bit in hybrid buses. Now 97 buses out of their 885 bus fleet, or 11%, are hybrid technology. And these are really, you get the payback on the local routes where you start and stop a lot. And Metro Transit now has a few years of experience using these hybrid buses, and they have documented that they get 21% greater fuel efficiency with this hybrid technology. So, for example, in 2010, they actually drove 800,000 less miles on the street than the previous year, but they used 600,000 gallons less of fuel. So you can see the impact with just 11% of the fleet being with that technology. And then Metro Transit has also been a leader in biodiesel fuel. I think this is very important because Metro Transit is the largest consumer of fuel, of diesel fuel, in the state of Minnesota. Last year, they used 7.2 million gallons of fuel. And they have been experimenting, trying to maximize the use of biodiesel. They use up to 20% fuel, primarily in the summer months. They have to back down a little bit off that in the winter. But again, they're a leader. And, Mr. Chair, they're also working with the University of Minnesota on other advances in fuels, such as some bus electrical system things where we can have things run not on diesel fuel but on more the electrical system of the bus. So this is just an example, and the point I'd like to emphasize is that we are continually looking for efficiencies on an ongoing basis. I mentioned that we were able to have some labor
issues. Excuse me, Mr. McCarthy.
Yes.
Senator Reiner.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sort of on a tangent, but if you'd humor me for a minute, and I don't know, Judd, or who's working the laptop, if you want to go back to the previous slide.
Sorry.
Thank you. You know, as we look at needing to find some alternative for per gallon taxation to maintain our road system, I mean, you highlighted the great things that you're doing in terms of reducing mileage, reducing fuel usage with your hybrid buses and biodiesel fuel usage. I would have to think that the Met Council's got some interest in what an alternative might be. I mean, especially with your transportation system, bus system, you're in the business of driving down the roads. And, you know, if we get to some point where you're running all hybrid buses or all alternative fuel buses, we're not going to, in our current system, we're not going to have a way to have a decent road for you to run those buses on. So I'm just curious if you all have kicked that idea around yet, or?
Ms. McCarthy?
And no is an acceptable answer.
I'm just trying to make sure I understand your question, Mr. Chair. So you're talking about the roads versus the bus investment, or?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Senator Reiner.
You know, we've got a situation where where most of our transportation funding comes from us paying a per gallon tax. And as we get more efficient vehicles or vehicles that aren't using gas as their primary source, we've got a problem.
Mr. Chair, I get it now. Thank you for that second go on that question. Yes, I understand what you're saying. And that has actually been a trend, and it's been a very big concern for MnDOT. It's not that dissimilar from with transit operating funding being provided by motor vehicle sales tax. It is a little bit of an oxymoron, I think, for some of us to process. But we are aware that, yes, the funding sources that we have traditionally relied on, not only in this region but across the country, I think that you could argue at the federal level they're struggling with these same questions. And the question that is out there is what should be the funding sources for these, particularly as the traditional funding sources have been decreasing. So, yes, we're very aware of the situation that you point out, and we do talk about it, but we haven't come up with the solution either.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair, if I might, just
Mr. Bourne
and Senator Reiner, the clues that we have from other communities and other regions around the country tell us that and I know that this will not be embraced by everyone, but typically our regional or statewide sales tax is dedicated to transit and transportation. The advantage there is that it's a more stable source of income, but it is not as closely tied to the activity that is desirable. So you trade stability for the desired trait, stability, for something that is not as linked to the activity. But nevertheless, there are a number of regions in the country where agencies like ours that are in the transit service business rely on a dedicated sales tax for that purpose. We do have that to some degree in the region, with counties having the authority to impose sales taxes that fund light rail and transit, both principally capital, but some operations too. So we seem to have some, in this case, hybrid of both sales taxes in some ways and these other more related to the activity, the motor vehicle sales tax. And we're going to talk about the motor vehicle sales tax in just a second, and you can see the lack of reliability of that revenue source.
Ms. McCarthy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what we're showing here is over about the last decade what has been happening with our workforce. As I mentioned earlier, we have gained some efficiencies where we were able to reduce our workforce numbers through technology improvements. And you can see there on the third line that on our combined bus operations, we've been able to reduce the workforce by about 9.5%. Now, if you went back to that ridership bar chart that I'd shown, you would see that during that time, bus ridership was essentially flat. So we did reduce our FTEs at a greater rate than the service was changing. So that's a very positive for us there. But probably more importantly is collectively, over the last decade, we have added on two new modes. We've added light rail operations and commuter rail operations, both of which have required new divisions, new technical expertise to run those systems. And when you look at the total picture here of our transit operations, even bringing on those new modes, we have reduced our workforce by 0.9%. So we feel very good about that accomplishment and that we're able to provide more service. And I think this just reflects how we always are working towards greater efficiencies. Mr. Chair, as Regional Administrator Bourne just promised, here is a chart on our revenues and expenses. We did share this with you back in January when we were here, but we just wanted to have a little refresher here. You will see the general fund, which is the topic of our presentation today is about 14% of our budget at $57 million. This is for, of course, the current calendar year 2011. And then that red slice is the motor vehicle sales tax at almost half. And that is very important to us. And then passenger fares are at about 24%. It's important to know, though, you remember that family of services that I showed. The fares cover a much higher percentage on light rail and regular bus and a lower percentage on services such as Dial-A-Ride and the Metro Mobility type services. So passenger fares at 24% is a system-wide average. But again, there's quite a bit of variety. We did want to talk to you about the motor vehicle sales tax quite a bit. First of all, just some other financial uncertainties before we get to the motor vehicle sales tax. Fuel prices, I am sure you, like all of us, have been reading the headlines in the papers lately. There have been predictions that fuel prices will go up, some say by $4 by the end of the year. And you'll remember on that bar chart, 2008, we did have a spike in ridership because of the fuel prices, and we would anticipate that that would happen again. So what happens is our demand goes up, but concurrently our cost to deliver the same operations also increase. For every 10-cent rise in a gallon of diesel fuel, that equates to an $800,000 financial impact for our operations. So it is not insignificant. Fuel is our second largest expense at 8% of our budget. Now, we do use fuel forward pricing. We've been doing this for quite a few years. We apply about 85 to 90% of our fuel, we do forward pricing. And what that gives us is budget certainty for the next 18 months, so to speak. Ultimately, as you redo your forward pricing, the market catches up with you, but for at least the short-term outlook, we have certainty on our budget, which is really what the great value to us is. But the fuel prices, I'm sure you can all understand, is a great concern for us.
Got a question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair, could you just go back to the slide on the operating budget?
Yes.
On the expense side, where do you have in there for administration, or is that not put into the metro area transit budget? I'm just wondering how you allocate for administration.
Yes, Mr. Chair, the administration is allocated across these different services here. So there is administration to deliver the bus service, and that's reflected in the bus budget. So our internal administrative costs are reflected in these costs here.
Senator Okay. Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering, you know, it might be helpful to know what we're spending on administrative parts of this. Mm-hmm. It's an operating budget. By looking at this, I can't tell, you know, like the chair is now, I think, out in Washington, D.C., correct?
That's correct.
Lobbying for...
Central Corridor.
For federal funding for the
Central Corridor,
the Central Corridor. Mm-hmm. Would that expense, is that out of another expense, or is that out of, is that expense or that travel expense put into this?
It's out of the chair's budget.
Or is that at a higher level, yes. Council?
Mr. Chair and Senator, this is the transit operating budget. The chair's office and the regional administrator, for example, is a separate regional administration budget of the Metropolitan Council. That is not part of the transit operating budget that
okay.
you see here.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
Just a comment. I mean, one of the things with us facing this budget situation that we're in, you know, we're looking at every expense across the board, mm-hmm. and I think it is helpful to know where those costs go, because I, as you know, the Senate has not approved any reimbursement for out-of-state travel without prior authorization. So I don't know if the chair just gets a travel expense and makes those decisions, or if they have prior authorization. But we're having a discussion, and the reason I bring it up is we're just having a philosophical discussion about, you know, whether we should be using taxpayer money to lobby for more taxpayer money, you know, to be spent. And with the use of video conferences and Skype and everything else, and, you know, I'm a I'm a proponent of high-speed rail. You know, I served on the Minnesota High-Speed Rail Joint Powers Authority, and when I couldn't, you know, when I'd travel up from Red Wing up here, I didn't seek reimbursement, and when I couldn't come, I would teleconference in, and it worked quite well. So that's more of a commentary, but I'm just wondering about, you know, we need to look at every expense, and I'm just wondering if that's just an allocated travel allowance and those decisions are made, or if there's prior authorization, or how that comes to be, because we're looking, you know, I know you're at a 30,000-foot level here, but, you know, I need to know how much of this is providing transportation and how much of this is the administration, and if we don't know that, how can we focus on improving efficiencies?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the chair is out in Washington, D.C., meeting with the FTA regarding the Central Corridor. And the council has a variety of operations that we do beyond the transit budget. And the administration of the regional administration, which is where the chair, the regional administrator, and the administrative functions of the council are funded through a regional property tax that the legislature gives the council the authority. So that is where those funds are coming from in this particular case. And what we have here is the state gives us a contribution out of the general fund for the transit budget, and we would be happy to provide you with the additional information you'd like based on these services that we provide through the general fund dollars. We can certainly do that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair, that explains part of it, but I would also like to know, I mean, those are taxpayer funds, too, at a higher level, you know, for the Met Council, and I'd like to know how those, you know, not saying that we have purview over that, but I'd like to know how those authorizations are made when somebody says, hey, I need to fly out to Washington, D.C. to talk to these people. You know, is that just a one-person decision, or is that put to a vote to see whether those are appropriate expenditures?
Mr. Shetner?
Mr. Chair and Senator, I'd be happy to get back to you on that. I think that I understand your question better, but I think a written response would be better than me trying to explain it right at this point.
Let me
Mr. Bourne.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I think you've asked a couple questions here. We'll certainly be happy to answer your question about admin costs as a percentage of transportation. You've also asked the question about who authorizes travel. Mm-hmm. The answer at Metropolitan Council is that it's me. The regional administrator authorizes travel under our travel policy. In this particular case, this particular person at the Metropolitan Council is traveling under the budget of the, as Judd has said, the regional administration budget.
Okay.
Are there other administrative cost questions that we can answer for you too, or we want to answer your questions, and I want to answer your question about who makes that decision, and in the Metropolitan Council's case, it's me. We don't make that decision lightly. It's made within budgets, and for the purposes for which we are in business, and travel, while it's not a large expense, it is certainly an expense that's controllable. And sometimes travel, we think, is necessary to conduct our work.
Well, Mr. Bourne, just one quick second. I think what Senator Howe is alluding to is while it's okay to look at these large numbers and pie charts, we have made a commitment to look a little deeper into what are the administrative costs. You know, you mentioned $800,000 saved or mm-hmm. more in expense for a gallon of fuel. You know, how much of this is in those expense categories? You know, what are we spending on the outside consultants to do the surveys? Those are the types of things that aren't reflected in a pie chart and big numbers. And what the challenge is for us as a committee is to have a better understanding of, and our desire is to have a better understanding of where those dollars are allocated and how they're spent. And so I think in the overlying desire on the part of Senator Howe and others on this committee is just to get a little, not just a little, a lot more in-depth into these budgets so that we can take a business-like approach. This type of approach to presenting a budget is very different than what you see in the business community, where you have a chart of accounts that lays out where all of these expenses are, where the revenues are coming. This is it's hard to ferret through where we're going with these budgets, and we just want a bit of a more comprehensive approach taken, a more business-like approach taken when we're presenting these budgets, and so that we have a better understanding. But we'll move in that direction. Your assistance will help us, and we look forward to the response to Senator Howes and others' questions about more detailed information. We have Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I think it would be useful, you know, travel always gets people's attention. You know, especially when even in good times, but certainly in tight times. And, you know, the state has, for the most part, adopted a fairly strong standard of scrutiny for travel. But of course, we know that occasionally travel is important and necessary. I think in this particular instance, it's probably pretty important for the brand new chair of the local regional government to meet for the first time with the Federal Transit Administrator in D.C., probably face to face. But you know, what is the standard of scrutiny that the Met Council? I'm not asking for that now, but if you have a standard policy that you use as guidance to scrutinize a requested trip, that would probably help.
Senator Gazelka, did you have a question? Okay. I thought we saw your hand go up. Senator DeCray.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman. To echo somewhat the chairman's message was, I guess one of the slide before showed just a few numbers that are adopted in your budget and the change that you're looking to make, but I would like to see an awful lot more detail than that. I'd like to see, you know, I know he mentioned where the money's coming from. I'd like to know how much of this is subsidized, either federal, subsidized by state. I'd like to see an awful lot more detail than this, so that we have an opportunity to really take a bigger picture look at your budgets.
Sure. This is just transit,
McCarthy,
right?
Exactly.
Or other Judd, do you have a
Mr.
Shetland?
Go ahead,
Mr.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. If we're going to go down that path with Metro Transit, I certainly would like to go down that same path with MnDOT. I don't remember this level of scrutiny and detailed questions. What level of subsidy? We subsidize 44% of our roadway spending in Minnesota through the property tax. And there's a lot of administration over at MnDOT.
And travel.
And the like.
And abusive travel.
So, I'm all for scrutinizing detail, and they certainly do account for their dollars on a per account basis. We can have that detail. I'd like the same detail for MnDOT, which we didn't seem to be interested or request when they made their presentation.
And Senator Dibble, that request has already been made to all of the agencies that we would like to transition to a more of a business model when we're approaching showing us how these budgets are handled. I've had complaints on the part of a lot of people across the board that say that it's so hard to figure out just exactly how the dollars are being spent on these projects, and you know, everything including change orders and what effect that has on a road project you don't see in these budget numbers. We don't have an understanding. And I believe that, I guess my vision of this, of the Transportation Committee, is that we are like a board of directors in that we need to understand where all of this is coming from, because we're the board of directors over the taxpayers' dollars. We have a responsibility to them to understand this better than big pieces and chunks going here and chunks going there, and not the level of accountability and reporting that we see, transparency, if you will, that we see in the business community. We put out the word that we want the greater detail, a cleaner, more transparent approach, we're going to be requesting that of all of the agencies going forward. Senator Rest?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Bourne, Mr. Shetland. When is the Who does your financial audits? And
State.
When was the latest one done, and can you provide that to us?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, the state auditors audit the council, and I will provide you with the most recent audit. I'm not sure.
Annually?
It's done annually. I'm just not sure what time of the year it's done, but I'd be happy to provide that.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Shetland, were there any findings in the latest audit?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, there was nothing material found by the state auditor.
Internal controls, no findings, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, while I don't have it in front of me, what I'm being told is that there were no material findings or internal control problems.
Mr. Chairman, I think that that document would be a very good one for us to be looking at. And I appreciate your concern of having all that kind of information. What I don't want, I'm not interested in knowing, is how much money they spent on toilet paper. I'm not interested in that level of detail. I don't think a board of directors would ask for that either. So I think we have to have some common sense about what parts of the budget are really important for us to scrutinize and which parts are too much detail to even comprehend, is a suggestion.
Senator Rest, I think you and I and probably the rest of the committee are all on the same page on this. Good. It's just it seems to me, along with others, that it's a transparency issue. We don't want to know how much toilet paper they buy or anything like that. No board of directors would want to know that. But we also want to be able to see clearly in the numbers what the effects are and have a greater understanding based off of sound accounting principles and more of a business type of approach and structure than what we're seeing in these documents and in these reports. So any other questions?
Mr. Chair, now I'm just going to disagree because I want to know how much pepperoni my place buys so I know how much, if any, theft that there might be. Not that there could be, but I just heard Senator Rest make a comment that there was abusive travel going on in MnDOT. Senator Rest, I have the floor. Senator Rest, excuse me.
Adjudicated.
Senator Rest, we will.
We
will abide by the decorum of the Senate and allow Senator Perry to make his point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, because I want to know just how things are being disseminated, and if I don't have a handle on the product that I'm purchasing, to know how much is being placed here as opposed to what's being purchased, I don't know what might not be taken out of the back door. So I am concerned about the little things as well as the big picture things. And I think it's just our right as citizens and as representatives of citizens to at least have the documentation. So if some of us would like to take a look at that, we have the right to do that.
And what we don't see from a business-like perspective is a chart of accounts, which is a generally accepted accounting principle that you lay out those charts of accounts and you have your revenues and your expenditures. We don't see that in a lot of the documents that we see coming to us as far as budget. And again, it's just about transparency. Senator Rest, did you have a comment?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I apologize if I violated any rules of decorum.
I just want to run the committee as thoroughly as you did, Senator Rest.
I apologized if I violated any rules of decorum. But I do think that it is that we need to examine our role as an oversight committee as much as and what that is. And maybe we ought to have a discussion in general. You talked about Senator Howe, which I appreciated, kind of the philosophical discussion about what is the correct level of oversight that would mean the most to the taxpayers, for example. And I would welcome that kind of discussion so that the standards that we ask people to meet in providing us information are equally transparent and clear. And I think that would be a very worthwhile discussion about all the agencies that would come here, DPS and motor vehicles and the overall non-transit operating budget of Met Council, what their salaries are, all that kind of information, what kind of reimbursement they get, I mean, what those policies are. I mean, we should discuss whether that's useful information to us.
And I agree, Senator Rested. Maybe you are just volunteering for a committee that we were talking about putting together to look at this very subject. And well, you, I think your input would be valuable on that in that discussion. So, any other volunteers that want to throw up their hand right now, it'll make my job easier as we take a look
Mr.
at
Chairman.
Transparency within. Senator
I volunteer, Rush. Senator Perry.
I knew that one was coming, Mr. Chair.
Well, very good. It's a good conversation, and we'll let the Met Council go ahead with their presentation.
And Mr. Chair and members and Senator Rest and Senator Gims, as you were just mentioning, there is the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Governance that exists that the House and Senate participate in with 7 members from each body that already exists to oversee metropolitan area governance between the Council, the MAC, and the Sports Facilities Commissions and broader groups. So I just wanted to make sure everybody is aware that that is there, and I know the House just made their appointments last week. So.
Very good, and just so the committee knows that committee hasn't met since 2008.
Right.
We're going to rev it up on a couple of different areas. So, Senator Rest?
Mr. Chairman, that brings up a point to me. Now, this committee doesn't have jurisdiction over Metropolitan Council in any way. We only have jurisdiction over the transit operations. So I think it's probably Senator Vandeveer's committee that is the accountable Senate standing committee that has jurisdiction over review and oversight of the Met Council in general. So actually, the comment that I made about knowing salaries of Met Council members and so on, that's not this jurisdiction. That's a jurisdiction of the local government committee, not here, and or that group you just referenced.
You're okay. Correct, Senator Rest, and we are working with Senator Vandeveer on the metropolitan governance issues that are out there. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we will move forward here with our discussion, I think, of MBEST.
Right. So one of the financial uncertainties we'd like to highlight, Mr. Chair, is the motor vehicle sales tax revenues. This shows the statewide MBEST revenues back for a few years. You might recall that it was in 2003 that transit operation funding switched from property tax to the motor vehicle sales tax. And ever since that time, it has been on a decline. I think you can see from this chart a rather significant decline. Of course, not only transit operations, but some roads also receive the benefit of motor vehicle sales tax. So this impacts more than just transit. But what we'd like to highlight, in addition to what I think is very obvious, is the decline of revenues from just over $600 million a year back in 2003 to about $442 million in 2009. You will see some dashed lines on this chart. And those dashed lines are some of the previous forecasts for motor vehicle revenues here. And you can see that there has generally been a trend, as there continues to be today, that the sales tax revenue will rebound and in the relatively near future. Unfortunately, while we know that this is a very difficult revenue to forecast, we have not yet seen the rebound that has been forecast. And, of course, a lot of decisions are made based on this forecast regarding our funding. And so this forecast is very important to the Council as well as to MnDOT and others who use this funding source. You will see on this chart that the good news is there was an uptick for the first time between 2009 and 2010 on this chart. So that is a positive. However, we at the council do not have a high confidence level that the black dash line, which is the current forecast, is what really will come to fruition. But we are eagerly anticipating the next forecast to be issued next week by the state.
And Mr. Chair, if I could add real quick, in the rebound that we see between fiscal years 9 and 10,
mm-hmm.
one of the things that happened during that period was the Cash for Clunkers program,
right.
where many people purchased new vehicles. And so there was an uptick in the vehicle sales at that point. However, when a number of people go out and buy vehicles, that means they're not going to buy them again down the line. And so while we see the rebound, as Ms. McCarthy expressed, we do have some apprehension about that rebound coming as quickly as the forecast shows.
Well, and I think you'll maybe be able to find some solace in that GM announced today that their fourth quarter, their most recent quarter earnings were $540 million, and they made a profit into the billion. So that means additional car sales, and maybe with all of the car companies coming together, these projected paths might be actually closer to reality. So, Senator Howe.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering, do we have like an overlay here? When the Cash for Clunkers, was that Cash for Clunkers, was that 08 or 09? Was that?
Mr. Chair and Senator, we believe it was just over that period of time between
okay.
8 and 9.
I'm wondering, do we have an overlay, Mr. Chair, of the of what the tax rates were? I'm thinking back to the Jesse Ventura, Governor Ventura days where we had this, you know, accelerated or flat fee. If it was past 3 years, it was $99 to license your vehicle, and it was I'm just wondering if we can overlay that and see what happened with taxation going up versus revenue coming in and taxation going down. Do we have those numbers?
Mr. Chair and Senator, with the registration tax, that is a MnDOT fund.
Okay.
And I think that, you know, they would be able to provide that. Otherwise, I'm sure Ms. Boyd, as fiscal analyst, would be able to provide that for you. That is not a revenue source for our transit system.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator,
I would disagree somewhat because what's preventing me from buying a new car is the sales tax, you know, and so when you lower the registration fee, I think you increase the idea that it's not as costly to buy a new vehicle. When you go to buy a new vehicle and it's going to cost you $2,000 more for all the sales tax and registration, it is not mutually exclusive. You know, I mean, I think there is some that goes together there.
It's your license tab.
Senator Rust?
I'm sorry, now the idea of $2,000 sales tax. So I'm trying to calculate how much that car costs. my question, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Shetton, and Mr. Bourne, based on the Monday's forecast, is this chart going to change?
Mr. Shetton?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, I believe that the MVS forecast number will change. This is the November forecast, and the February forecast will change. And so it'll also change not just for the immediate time, it'll show a trend into the future, which is where we obviously have our concerns, because at that point, as you can see, or it'll be on our next slide, that we are fully phased in at the 36% of motor vehicle sales tax, and then we become even more dependent on it, because in our previous budget slide, you will see that 47% of our budget is the motor vehicle sales tax.
So, Mr. Chairman, obviously the next request would be to provide the committee with this updated chart that shows that a different trend line, or is it truly going to be better or worse based on the updated forecast, and even given that it's fully phased in.
Yeah. And Mr. Chair and Senator Est, our new regional administrator, prior to you saying that, said we should update this slide and provide that to you. So we will, on Monday afternoon or Tuesday, before your committee hearing, we will make sure that the committee has a copy of that updated forecast for the motor vehicle sales tax.
Appreciate that.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Hall.
I just want to respond to Senator Rust's comment there. And I think maybe Senator Lilly probably already has the answer. So I see him calculating over there. But go ahead.
It's taxing.
Well, you know, we've got a lot of it's been great to be a new freshman in the Senate because we've got a lot of great business people that are pretty astute. I see him working over there on his calculator.
Well, if we could get a dollar value for that vehicle.
But I don't think $2,000 sales tax is putting a – I don't know if Senator Rest has looked at a new vehicle lately, but go ahead and tell me what that would buy me.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hall, that would be approximately $25,000, $477.70.
Yeah, I think a new truck that I'm looking at is a little more than that. So, but that is preventing me from buying a new vehicle. So just to let you know.
Senator Dibble?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe we should look at our per diem. We're Harmon Main Street here. Just on this issue of MBEST revenues and forecasting, and even you know going back a long ways, not just in the recent economic decline that caused such a precipitous drop in car sales, MBEST revenue, even in good times, has just been really volatile to the plus and to the minus. And, of course, we're you know, we're kind of duty-bound to build our budgets based on these economic forecasting models, and, you know, now for a couple years to a deafening response from the Office of Management and Budget and the state economist, deafening in its silence and lack of response, I've advocated that we take another look at how we forecast the motor vehicle sales tax so we both maybe forecast a bit more accurately. Mm-hmm. And also maybe build in some sort of volatility index to the plus and the minus so that we can budget appropriately, particularly at this agency, which relies so heavily on that source. It's a crazy way to do business, not really having an idea where to peg your anticipated dollars. We're working on it. I know the agency has been trying hard to get their oar in the water with that agency, too. So if anyone from MMB is listening, 2 years now we've been in conversation about this. I'd like a response.
Seems like our everything about our budget is volatile, including the general fund dollars. And so,
this is particularly
an interesting
volatile.
Certainly. Okay. Continue with your...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This slide zeroes in on a subset of the total statewide MBEST. This zeroes in on our regional share. And the way we describe this is that you already saw the shrinking pie on the previous slide, but what this slide portrays is that we've been getting a larger share of that shrinking pie. So you will see at the bottom we have the years, and then below the years we have the percent share of motor vehicle sales tax that has come to transit operations. So as was previously described, our share has grown from 03, from 20.5% to the fully phased in result of the constitutional amendment at 36% here in year 2012. So as Mr. Shetland just described, while motor vehicle sales tax has been dropping, the good news is that for transit operations, we were receiving an incrementally greater share, and that helped offset to a certain degree the decline, getting more of a smaller share. So you can see that from 2003 to 2010, the share of regional motor vehicle sales tax revenues increased from 20.5% to 31.5%. In other words, more than a 50% increase in share of motor vehicle sales tax. However, during that same time period, you can see our actual collections decreased from changed from $124.1 million up to $141.9 million. So that was an increase of $17.8 million, which is good news, but it was only a 14% increase when our share increased 50%. And then again, as Mr. Shetland just explained, part of that we also think was due to the cash for clunkers. So very recently, looking from 09 to 010, we had an increase of $19.3 million in actual receipts from state fiscal year, but that was more than offset by a reduction of state general fund appropriation of $21.5 million. So it just kind of shows what we'd like to emphasize is the instability of our motor vehicle sales tax. Again, as you have just discussed, we too are waiting next week for that forecast. It is very important to us. And as has already been pointed out, this forecast has been the basis for decisions for our general fund. And we'd like to just move on to the state general fund. What we've received from the state is shown here over the last 4 years. You can see that we did take some reductions, particularly our total in for 2011 was dropped down to 49.2%. And then based on current law, in years 12 and 13, we would anticipate receiving $65 million. However, as you know, the governor's recommendation is the reduction that we talked about of $5.4 million a year, so we would be at $59.6 million. We just want to highlight, I think, with what Regional Administrator Bourne started off with here, we do know that you and many other committees face difficult decisions, as well as the governor in trying to balance our budget. We know that there's difficult choices to be made, and we recognize that the new council, which will be coming in here in early in March, the new Met Council will also similarly need to make some decisions based on our actual funding levels. So that's kind of where we're at. We recognize it must be managed, and we're willing to look at that. Just so you know what some of the priorities and actions that have been set for the council, we traditionally try to maintain the service that's on the street as our top priority. We also like to seek structural solutions. And what we mean by that is we want a solution that can be sustained. We don't want to have a one-time short-term solution only to have to come back in a year or two and solve the same problem again. So we do look for what we call our structural solutions that can be carried forward. There was a good discussion today on regional budgets. We do have a history of reexamining all of our regional budgets, and we would continue to do that in this situation. And then until we really get the forecast for motor vehicle sales tax next week, that's really a linchpin piece of information for us to be waiting for, because that will help us understand the situation with that very large funding source for us. So, Mr. Chair, that's kind of our big next step, is waiting on that news next week. And, Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to answer more questions at this point.
Are there any additional questions, Senator Howe?
Mr. Chair, I just want to clarify. It's not the sales tax that's preventing me from buying a new vehicle. It's not that. It's the registration tax. Yes. It just keeps given, or keeps taken, I should say. The sales tax, we all expect to pay that. But that combined with the motor vehicle registration tax, the way it's set up now, and if you're looking at, you know, a fairly nice
first
vehicle.
Year,
yeah,
yes.
I mean, well, it's first not even the first year. It's the second year, the third year, the fourth year. It's not, you know, it used to be under Ventura that it went, and the third year it went to $99, and that was, everybody thought that was fantastic. I know some agencies didn't think that was fantastic, but that is, you know, if you're looking at investing or buying a vehicle and making that purchase, that is a tax that I think at least most business people look at. You know, do I want to make that investment in a new vehicle and have to pay that registration tax? We all expect to pay that sales tax. I mean, but I left the impression that it was a sales tax, but I think it goes hand in hand. That registration tax being so high, it does affect the revenues that we get. And one of the questions I had earlier when we had that budget presentation given was, if we relied less on the motor vehicle sales tax and registration tax and relied more on either the gas tax, if we changed that, would it improve car sales? Would we see a spike in additional sales? Would we get additional revenue from additional sales? Would it help our economy? And if it is, then maybe we should make it more affordable to buy a new vehicle to help our economy. And, you know, is our formula right, the way we rely on the motor vehicle registration, the motor vehicle sales tax, and the gasoline tax? Mm-hmm. Should we be more reliant on the gas tax and give a break on the other deal, on the other two? And would that improve our economy and therefore give us greater revenues? Just a question that I posed, you know, a few weeks back. So, and I don't purport to have the answer on that or know the answer on that, but it's just one of those things I think we should be examining.
Senator Rust.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Howe, I think another complicating factor in that is that the unless we raise gas tax again, we're going to see diminishing returns from the gas tax because we have more fuel-efficient cars. And so we need to there was a proposal at one time to have the tax not leveled on the volume of gas or by gallon, but was that lane miles or something? And
miles driven.
What, Mr. Chairman, what was it called?
Vehicle miles driven.
Yeah, vehicle miles driven. So there might need to be, if we wanted to rely on tax that came from fuel consumption, we may well have to reform that system in and of itself as well.
Any other questions? Senator Sanjo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to go back to this issue of efficiencies. It's like the question I always wanted to ask but never had a chance to ask it. And, you know, we all kind of talk by our life circumstances. I happen to live on a bus route here in downtown St. Paul. And I don't have any facts, obviously. I just have perceptions. But those perceptions are, generally speaking, that bus ridership at night is pretty light. And you see these big two-bus caravans coming down 10th Street and Minnesota and so on and so forth. And at midnight, at 1 in the morning and so on, there's one or two people. And I don't know if they go hourly or every 20 minutes or whatever, but I've even asked our bus operator in Rochester about it. He said, you know, they'd be better off if they just gave everybody a taxi cab voucher. And in his belief, they'd save money. But so the question is, have you ever kind of taken a look at ridership by hour of the day, mm-hmm. and thought at least about whether or not what we're doing is really cost effective, running the big buses as we seem to do them, seemingly, I think, all night. I don't know for sure. Maybe the weekends, things like that there. Maybe using smaller buses, et cetera. I'm sure you've looked at it. It's a question that I'm sure you've gotten 1,000 times yourself. But as at least I look at it and see it, having, you know, living on the bus line, it frankly, it looks ridiculous.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps I can provide a little information to answer your questions. There is quite a bit of good data. One of the other technology improvements we've added over the last few years are what are called automatic passenger counters, and we know how many people get on and off a bus at each bus stop, and that also helps us calculate how many people are on the bus at every point along each trip on each route. So that has been very helpful. We definitely have quite a bit more service in this region compared to our peer regions in service during the peaks. We are a system that is more focused on the commuter rush hours and 5 days a week, but we also do have a lot of local service that operates 7 days a week and beyond the rush hours. And we do monitor that. I think not all routes operate the same number of hours. There are definitely kind of core routes in the off-peak hours. It's not uncommon that people would have to walk further to catch a bus. Maybe the choices are a little bit less. But the other thing that's important that we look at is not everybody works those standard 8-to-5 types of shifts. There are a lot of jobs where you start much earlier or you work later, and people can't, they need to get both to their job and home from their job. And if they can't get home at night, then they won't take it in, which is maybe more during the heavily used hours. But we do have regional performance standards that the council has adopted. We do an annual review of those performance standards, and we compare similar groupings of routes. So we compare express routes to other express routes, local routes to other locals, and suburban local to suburban local. So we kind of group them, and we basically compare them to each other, and we have some standards, and if a route isn't performing relatively within certain statistical parameters of its group of peer routes, then we identify those routes to either be eliminated or to be changed in some fashion. We are continually looking at routes. It's an ongoing part of work, I think, of all the providers. As you look at your routes and you look at their performance and make changes, that's an ongoing part of our business.
Mr. Chair, and I'm not quarreling with, you know, the need for service even 24 hours a day. I just wonder sometimes if we're providing the service in a cost-effective fashion and whether or not we need a double-length bus versus a smaller vehicle, perhaps, that might in and of itself save us some money operating from an operating point of view. I don't know this. These are just perceptions I have. It just seems when you see it, and you see it time after time after time, where middle of the night we've got these two, you know, these double-length buses with one or two people in it, just doesn't look very efficient. And maybe it is. I just don't know.
Mr. Chair, I could thank you. I had forgotten about that part of your original comment. There's a few factors that come into play. First of all, routes start at one point, and that's where the loads. If you see a bus at its starting point, it might have only a couple people on, but as it goes down its route, it picks up more people. And so we do look at scheduling, how frequent service is, with that in mind also, because that is a very common phenomenon. And you're right about the bus size, that we do have small buses in our fleet. A suburban circulator-type service traditionally would use a small bus because over the course of the total trip, a bus that seats 20 people, for example, or 25, is adequate. But the other thing to keep in mind is that a bus, let's say a bus is out on the street for over 8 hours of work, and maybe 4 of those hours we need the larger capacity bus. It's very full, but the bus stays out there to finish for the trip. It's actually more cost effective to keep that same larger bus out there operating rather than to drive out of service to a garage and drive a smaller bus back. In the trade-off, it costs more to do that. So that scheduling system that I explained to you, that's a lot of what it does, too, for example, is help us put those packages of work together. But there are many factors. The fuel efficiency, of course, a small bus is more fuel efficient. So those are important things to consider.
Senator Sandra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe, again, given the opportunity, and we don't need the answer today, but in particular, if you're in outstate Minnesota, and you know we kick around light rail a little bit, and we hear these numbers about North Star, an $83 ticket as it should be, they pay $16 or whatever. Do you have any idea what those numbers are? At some point, could you? We had a certain person, I think, that's president of the Taxpayers League, used to say that anytime you walked in the light rail, it's going to cost the state $7,000 for that ride. Well, that's maybe not right, but what are the right numbers is my question, and I don't need them today. But along the way, it would be kind of, I think, good for us to really, what really is the ridership cost versus the fee collected, so to speak.
Mr. Chair and Senator, we can provide that. As I said, we do an annual route performance by. Similar types of service, and as I pointed out on the slide before, it does vary quite a bit between types of service. If you look at compare light rail to express bus to local bus, and we look at all those different categories because they really are different market types. So we do have all that information, and we can just provide that
to
you.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Chair, Senator Senjum's questions are very fair, and stuff that we should know. The point that Ms. McCarthy made was the point I was going to make. I took the 53 last night from downtown St. Paul to uptown where I live, and at any point along the way, there were maybe a half a dozen of us on the bus, So it looked empty-ish. But dozens, literally dozens of people cycled on and off the bus during that entire route. I mean, that's about as far as that route goes. It's end-to-end. So literally dozens of people cycled on and off, taking shorter trips. And to be sure, those were folks who were riding the bus for all kinds of reasons, but you could tell a lot of them were you know, late shift workers. I was coming home from Mankato days. So there were a lot of late shift workers. But when, you know, when we're looking at this question of efficiency, you know, and the interest, and you know, Senator Carr, don't misinterpret what I said in response to your comments. I think we should take a look in great detail at all of these line items, these budget matters, and the efficiency. I think that's a good thing, but we just need to be consistent and fair. And, you know, the example, of course, is the pressure is always in the metro area to build our lane miles to accommodate what amounts to, you know, 3-4 hours a day's worth of pressure on those lanes, and that's the peak hours. In the meantime, you know, in all the rest of the day, you know, the 20 hours, we've got excess capacity. That's a lot of capital we put into the ground to serve a fairly narrow window of time. There's some ideas that MnDOT is bringing forward. How can we, you know, do the high return, lower cost projects, that sort of thing? I think that's good. But when we're measuring, you know, what is the cost, we also need to keep in mind, what is the cost of not getting those third shift workers to and from their job? You know, I mean, if we could stick them in a taxi cab and that's cheaper, I'm all for it. So let's do that if the analysis holds up. But, you know, there's external things that occur as a result of making investments in transportation that have real cost and consequence if we don't do those things. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I don't think anybody here is arguing that point. It's just some of us believe that it's the purview of this committee and those of us that are involved in the decision-making process to be able to understand how they're making their decisions.
I agree.
That's absolutely what we need to understand, and that's all we're asking for. Senator Sharon?
Yeah, I've served on, when I was serving on the city council, this is a long time ago, as you know, David, I was on the transit committee in the city of Mankato, and it's the same questions that we're asking, and it's really difficult to, you know, the ridership is low at certain times of the day. Are you going to the right locations? Is the route right? Can't you get smaller vehicles? Well, then we'd have to buy more vehicles, and then we put the bigger vehicles that are needed sometime offline. The efficiencies of some of these vehicles to run in terms of gas is pretty good, even though the size is big. Mm-hmm. It really doesn't cost a lot to operate it. The size doesn't necessarily correlate with cost of operating, but it does create an impression in the public. It did in Mankato, and it does in the general public, that fuels that worry that we're not being wise with how we're spending public dollars. And, you know, so we have to ask these questions. The public assumes that it's just inefficiency when they're seeing it. We have to have the answers to be able to talk about it in the public.
Thank you. Senator Dibble?
Mr. Chair, I find that I agree with Senator Dibble that we do want to be fair and equitable and look at all of the areas under our purview equally. And I do encourage us to continue to do that. That is important that we look at MnDOT, we look at everything that we're doing with the same microscope, with the same understanding of that. At the same time, if I'm sitting in the chair of Mr. Shetnan, Ms. McCarthy, Mr. Bourne, I want to be aware of what parameters I'm working under. What are the criteria that I am performing my duties under? And are they the same duties? Are they the same priorities? Are they the same areas that we have had in the past? And I believe that our focus in this legislative body is shifting from what it has been in the past. So if I'm sitting in these chairs testifying, I don't want to wait for the final discussion on the budget to find out that the numbers that I'm working with are different than what I anticipated them to be, that the priorities that I'm working with are different than what I anticipated them to be. So I think having this discussion, even if it feels like we're probing a little deeper in some areas than others, I think it's a healthy discussion because if I'm sitting in these chairs, I am asking myself, what is the end result of the budget process going to be this year, and what am I going to be dealing with? So I think this is a very healthy discussion. I do agree with Senator Dibble. We need to do this with all of our areas of expertise and purview. But I also think that it's important that we are hearing the message that this committee is going to be looking closely at how we're investing our dollars, where they're going, and do they fit the priorities of this committee as it sits today, as well as it has in the past. So I'm not offering advice. I'm just saying that I agree with Senator Dibble.